Hello, my name is Mike Swanson, and you are listening to the Reggie's House podcast. I am joined forever and always by my good friend, cohort, and hockey nerd, Andrew Roman. Andrew, how are you?
I'm well, man. How are you doing?
It's good to be back in the saddle. I feel like after this little hiatus, I'm just excited to be back podcasting again. It's just good to be talking to you for hours on end. So
yes,
I can't complain. How about yourself?
Yeah, I mean that's it, man. We're back. That's kind of the most. We're back. The Pens are back in the Stanley Cup final. Like, you know, what could be better?
Well, honestly, not much. I mean, given the way that the regular season ended with the injuries piling up and it just seeming like that. Like, the hockey gods are forever trying to handicap the Penguins because they're just, like, not allowed to have the talent that they do. I'm just excited that these boys have clawed and scratched and limped their way back to the finals.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it says a lot about... I mean, there's so many, you know, kind of great narratives coming out of this season and as we enter into the Stanley Cup Finals. But, you know, I think it just says so much about the quality of Mike Sullivan and Rick Tocchet and Jacques Martin as coaches to get this team performing at such a level despite all the injuries and despite, you know, continued absences of key guys like Crystal Tang, notably, you know, but also just the leadership as well. I mean, I know, you know, that's not necessarily what we've ever wanted this podcast to be about or anything, you know, sort of looking at intangibles, but I mean, you can't ignore it. I mean, I think this is the year where we can say, hey, the intangibles are what are carrying the Penguins, at least to a certain extent.
Well, and if you look back to, you know, the 2011, 2012, 2013 iterations of this team, those were completely missing, right? This was the team that would blow up at every missed call by the refs, every liberty taken with a star, every bad goal given up. I mean, it's amazing to me that they have turned this team around from what felt like sometimes, and I will be the first to admit this, a bunch of really rich, petulant children, you know, running around on the ice to a team that's just insanely disciplined, is focused, is going to come in, and they're just going to get their job done, right? It's a very workmanlike team, which you would not expect from the folks on that team, given how much talent is just littered throughout the roster.
No, absolutely. You know, I think there's certainly a strong case to be made that, you know, once upon a time, and it's interesting because when you look at, you know, the core of this Penguins team, it really hasn't changed since, like, say, that 2012 Flyers series that I think comes to mind most commonly when you're thinking about, like, you know, the petulant Penguins.
Right.
You know, and to think that it's still, you know, the same guys. I mean, it's still Sid, it's still Gino, it's still Chris Letang, you know, although obviously he's been injured this year. But, you know, it's the same guys that are kind of leading the way, and they figured it out. You know, I think, again, that's, you know, partially a testament to Sully as a coach, just kind of saying, like, I literally don't care what you think right now. You're going to stay in line. You know, I think is a great thing, but also just, you know, those guys took it upon themselves and said, hey, we're going to be better. You know, we're going to use our innate talent and just beat teams on the ice. We don't need to do it in extracurricular play. We don't need to do it, you know, in a war of words, in post-game press conferences. We're just going to play the game.
Although Jay Beagle seems to be an idiot, according to Phil Kessel, which, can I tell you, that was in the middle of that series. Like, okay, looking back on that comment, just for a second, given what we saw out of Kessel in the Ottawa series, just fired up Phil, angry, waving his arms around. I mean, to me, I couldn't send the tweet, but there were probably at least three or four times where I had a gif of Phil Kessel, you know, flailing his arms next to Don Vito from Viva La Bam, flailing his arms next to each other. And, like, I just love Phil Kessel too much to send that because it just would have been devastating. But, I mean, looking back on that comment in the middle of that series where, you know, tempers are high, like, there's emotion dripping out of just everywhere, right? To quote the Justin Pierre from Motion City soundtrack. I just got emotion dripping out of every pore. And I just thought I would let you know that. But, and then you've got Phil Kessel calling him an idiot. And then Jay Beagle firing back with challenging him to a Mario Kart race. I mean, I'm not really sure what happened, but the levity that that brought, you know, seeing Phil on the ice in Game 7 take a shot and just, like, stand around, pound around with Dana Heinze and some of the other trainers and Ron Hainsey. And it just goes so far to show you what the culture of that locker room looks like today compared to, you know, 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, a night and day difference.
Well, I agree. You know, and I think, and I think that says something to sort of the character of other players that have joined the organization since that point. You know, I think Phil is a big part of that. You know, I think he's a guy that's just good at, you know, keeping the situation light. I think some people might challenge that he does it a little bit to an extreme sometimes, but, you know, but I thought that was a wonderful moment when he did, you know,
Don Cherry.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is going to be wonderful. I'm really just hoping that the Stanley Cup final is actually just like a one-on-one matchup between between Phil and PK Subban, but instead of like one-on-one, they're just like just going for a nice little skate around the ice, like doing some dances at
talking.
Yeah, and just having a nice chat. You know, I think that would be the best way to settle this finals series. You know, all of the great NHL personalities in one place.
Yeah. Oh, I would love it. I would love it. But let's get back on track here, because I know we're going to try to keep it tight today.
Yes.
So for those of you listening, this is actually being recorded a few hours before game one of the Stanley Cup final, Labor Day Monday, or Memorial Day Monday, sorry. Don't mean to offend there. But yeah, we're taking a look. I do, you know, as we were talking about this last night, Andrew, I was fighting the temptation to do like just devolve into a full-on nerd session on the stats and strategy.
Yes.
That we have tried to build this podcast around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, getting back to that kind of difference between this year, this team, and last team, I know, you know, Dejan Kovacevic did a really nice article last week about the differences between this team. But I think most strikingly is that they've gotten to this point in a completely different fashion than they did last spring. And so the stats back it up, too. It's just not an eye test kind of thing.
Right.
It's literally night and day different from what got them there. So what are we looking at?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, you know, one of the kind of key things, and there's plenty of historical precedent that says that, you know, the teams that are dominant in puck possession tend to do really well in the postseason. And that was absolutely the case with the Penguins last year. I think they finished the regular season like second in the league in terms of Corsi 4, behind only Los Angeles. And, you know, I think a lot of people kind of felt like, okay, this is the team to watch, because they started getting much better at that as the year went on. And I think, you know, even going back to when we were, you know, actually doing this podcast on a more regular basis, Mike, you know, I think we both assumed that the Penguins would regain that form, that they would become a dominant possession team again, because they were bringing back so much of the lineup from last year. But that really didn't happen. I mean, this year for the regular season, they ended up at 50.14%, which was good for 15th in the league in terms of score adjusted when either, you know, within one or tied in the third, they were at 50.11%, which was 17th in the league. So actually like below average. And this playoffs, I mean, they've been pretty much one of the worst possession teams. I mean, I think, you know, I think those numbers are a little misleading because, you know, I think they had a very specific game plan, particularly against Columbus, that they executed well, that led to pretty low possession, but led to a lot of goals, which, you know, I think they just, I mean, they really made a conscientious attempt to be a counterattacking team against Columbus. I mean, they kind of realized that in terms of the size and the heavy hitting that Columbus brings, they might not have been able to control the puck in the zone as much, but they were able to take advantage on odd man breaks, you know, and I think that was a very successful strategy. But then they also, you know, I think one of the things that I've read, or just maybe it's just even popped into my mind, is like, you know, against Washington, the Penguins basically were like the 2014-15 Buffalo Sabres. Like, their numbers were so bad that, like, they didn't even register on a chart in terms of possession. But, hey, they found a way. So, I mean, currently for the playoffs, they're sitting at, like, a 46.47%, which is, wow.
Yeah, not good. Definitely not good. And I'm just trying to pull up here. I should have had this done beforehand. But I'm just trying to look at their kind of advanced stats because, you know, we nerd out about that kind of stuff here. And if you don't like those kind of things, you probably won't like this podcast too much. But as I'm looking at it, you know, number one, when did the playoffs actually start? Do we remember the date on that?
Not the exact date. It was like mid-April, I think.
Well, I mean, I'm looking at their from April 1st until right now, the past month and a half, and that Corsi poor percentage just keeps going down and down and down.
Yeah.
And all that is to say, I mean, you know, I look at this team, and I think, you know, here's what I'm looking at. I think there's potentially, and this might be apostasy when it comes to the advanced stats community, but there might be a chink in the armor of things like Corsi 4. And I think you're seeing it with, there's two different things that I can think of, and that I do want to jump into specifically how the Penguins are kind of using a low Corsi 4 to their advantage. So two, I think, disadvantages to this Corsi thing. If you're not sure of what Corsi is, it's literally just the amount of shots generated. So whether they're blocked, whether they miss the net, whether they hit the net, whether they're goals, doesn't matter. If a shot is generated, it goes in the Corsi 4 column. And so one of the things that we saw last season in the 2015-2016 season that I think was super, super interesting was that the LA Kings led the league in Corsi 4 percentage. But when you watch that team, were terrible. Like, not terrible, but they were a team that struggled very, very mightily in scoring goals. And when you watch how they're generating those shots, you watch a team who shoots a lot from the perimeter, crashes the net, and tries to bang home rebounds. If I recall correctly, they weren't exactly a very puck-lucky team last season because they're taking so many low danger percentage shots that unless you're getting the, you know, the fluky bounces and the wacky goals going in, they're just not turning into anything. And so I think you see that, and I think what you also don't see when it comes to counting this Corsi is teams that are good counter-punching teams. I think we saw that out of last season, out of the Tampa Bay Lightning in the playoffs, especially against a team like Pittsburgh, where they counter-punched really, really well and essentially mirrored Sullivan's game plan this season against the Capitals. It was like, we're content to get punches thrown at us wave after wave after wave. We're going to rely on a hot goaltender and trying to keep pucks out of the middle of the ice, and then we're going to counterpunch on the rush because we have legitimate scoring threats basically all over the ice. And you see how the Pens do that against, I think with more success against Columbus because, I mean, Columbus, I think, is a much less talented team than the Penguins were last year. But you also see the Pens execute it decently well against a really heavy forechecking team like Washington. And so on the stat sheet, this Corsi 4 percentage looks atrocious, right? Like hanging out around that 40 percentile or for like 40%. And anybody will tell you that that's not the key to winning hockey games. But Washington's golfing right now and the Penguins are playing for a second Stanley Cup in as many years. So how do we actually make sense out of this, out of a statistic that so many people have floated as like, you know, the new black when it comes to predicting success on the ice?
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that need to be taken into consideration. I mean, I think the first and foremost, it's important and imperative to remember that, like, all of the evidence that suggests that Corsi is important in predicting a Stanley Cup winner is very corollary, and therefore it's not, you know, it's a correlation. So literally it is not actually a prediction. You're just saying that there is a high level of incidence where teams that win the Stanley Cup are also good at possessing the puck. And, you know, and I think what we're seeing this year, though, I mean, because even Nashville, I mean, throughout the regular season, they were not really a dominant possession team, and they've been pretty much middle of the pack throughout the playoffs as well. I think they've fared a little better than the Pens in both instances, but you know, I think there's other ways that we have to look at it. And I think, you know, a topic that we've brought up before in terms of expected goals is also important, which that actually kind of weighs the value of a shot. Like, is it from a higher danger area? Is, you know, where did the shot go? Where, like, what goalie are they facing? And what is that goalie's tendencies? And I think what we start to see there is that the Penguins have actually fared a little bit better, than maybe we otherwise would think, and it kind of gets back to this notion that, 20 years ago in the mid to late 90s, the Penguins were this unbelievable offensive juggernaut. That was the height of, they literally ran five forwards on their power play, on their top power play, with Kevin Stevens like as the net front presence, and then Mario and Jager, and then they had Alexei Kovalev and Martin Straka on the points. Like, it was the most
absolutely silly.
It was the most ridiculous thing. But back then, nobody necessarily thought that much about the fact that those Penguins teams could take, half as many shots as their opponent and still win games very comfortably. Those were like absurdly high shooting percentage teams. And that's, I think, to a small extent, a little bit of what we're seeing here with this Penguins group. I think it's really important to make the distinction that, realistically, the Penguins probably have the three best forwards still in the postseason in terms of Sid, Gino, and Phil. And guess what? Mm-hmm. Those guys are 1, 2, and 3 in the postseason in scoring. It's about as clear as it gets.
Well, and if you're going to be a team that's limping into the playoffs that can't do the we're built on puck possession, but we can't possess the puck like we need to, you're going to need your big guns to step up and score timely goals and make timely passes and do elite player things, right?
Yeah.
You're going to need Sidney Crosby to wheel out of a corner and backhand saucer the perfect puck to Chris Kunitz in the high slot, right? You're going to need Evgeny Malkin to just bull his way to the net and score dirty goals. You're going to need Phil Kessel to be the sly, slippery, doughy Phil Kessel that we all know and love, right? I mean, doughy. You're going to need that. He's kind of doughy. I love Phil, but he's kind of doughy.
Yeah.
Phil, hearts, love you, buddy. but you need teams to do that. And I think, credit to this team that they have, so I don't like using the word opportunistic because I feel like it's a positive PR spin on our team played bad and didn't deserve to win, but we still won anyway.
Yeah.
And I don't know that that's necessarily the case because of exactly the way that the Pens team has been defending.
Right.
Right. So it's one thing to get shelled, and lose the shot clock battle by 15 or 20 shots, get out Corsi'd and out muscled by, 15, 20%. And then still win a game 3-2 because your goaltender stood on his head and the other team got unlucky. It's another thing entirely for teams to continue to try to shell the Penguins and just not be able to do it. And so they start resorting to these outside shots and just throwing everything at the net. I mean, I saw there was a video that the Penguins released of Game 7 that was, Mike Sullivan and Sidney Crosby mic'd up, and they had a directional mic pointed at Guy Boucher during one of the things, and you hear him very clearly say, throw everything at the net, even if it goes wide, it doesn't matter, it's still good, right? And so that's that mentality. You can't just say that because you're everything is going your way. You say that when the team that you're playing against is guarding the high danger scoring percentage chances on the ice, and you just need to get a lucky goal.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, and I think the kind of one of the key things is that if you're really going to, try to pack the box, which, obviously the Penguins have done very well, but also, I think it's something that we could also, point to Ottawa and say, well, they did that a lot too. If you're going to kind of pack it in around your goalie, that also tends to lead to a disproportionate amount of shots going against you. Because you're just not giving yourself the outlets that you need to maybe move the puck out or to kind of get a clear as quickly as you maybe would otherwise want it. you know, I think there's a little bit of, you know, you kind of have to play a certain higher risk. Well, I guess I should say it's, you know, it's a bit of a catch 22 because you're either right. playing a catch or you're either, you know, you're taking more of a chance by packing in around your goalie and not clearing the puck, or you're taking more of a chance that your defensive zone coverage gets weak if your guys blow the zone a little too early.
Right. Well, and the other thing that you notice with that is that you notice far fewer controlled zone exits from the defensive zone into the neutral zone, which is what the Penguins made their bread and butter last postseason, was that, like, you know, somebody would throw and this is why I love, I know we're going to come back to the Sullivan trap, and maybe this is a good time to talk about it, but the Sullivan trap, that 1-2-2 that just defends the blue line so well, they do it because the Pens defensemen, they're good skaters, right? They're mobile guys. They're forcing players to either make a decision that they're going to have to make a pass at the blue line or they're going to have to dump the puck in. And the opposing players know that they can't make that that pass, that little drop pass or that cross-seam pass coming in, specifically because the Pens forwards are back-checking super hard. And so when you look at, you know, Game 5 against Montreal where the Pens just – or not Montreal, sorry, Ottawa, where the Pens just lit them up, there were three goals – that came directly off of turnovers because the Pens pressured the Ottawa blue line and had forwards coming back, defensemen coming up. And so there was this like double pronged like pressure that was coming at him, forcing Ottawa's forwards to turn the puck over. Three goals came off of that exact type of thing, right?
Yeah.
That's where the Pens made their bread and butter last postseason, was being able to outmaneuver teams from the front and the back end, forcing them to dump pucks and allowing whatever mobile skating defenseman could go back, retrieve that puck, and then either skate it or pass it through the ice, getting it quickly to the forwards and launching that counterattack right away. You're seeing that far less this year because I think the Pens defense is banged up. It's a little bit less mobile. It's able to pressure that blue line less effectively. They're still good at it. Don't get me wrong. They're still, I think, one of the better teams at pressuring that blue line really effectively, but they're not as good at it. And so in that sense, what you see then is that when that puck gets dumped in, there's more pucks going off of walls into the neutral zone, right? It's getting cleared off the glass. It's getting, you know, just skyhooked into the center of the ice, not so that one of the forwards can skate under it and hopefully catch a break, but just because they need to get it out of the zone and get a change. And I think that that's one of the biggest reasons that you see the Pens not being dominant in possession, because they're missing a guy like Chris Letang, right?
Yeah.
They're missing, you know, guys are banged up. It's hard. It's not, Olli Mäto, we know that, you know, he's been much maligned this year. He's starting to come around to it. And I think there's a reason that you start to see the Penguins have a significant uptick toward the end of the Ottawa series, because, man, Trevor Daley comes in and he's moving the puck. Olli Mäto comes in and he's moving the puck. Justin Schultz comes in and he's moving the puck again. I mean, you start to see the Penguins getting back to that identity that was such a recipe for success last postseason. But you're still missing the biggest key piece in that, in Chris Letang, who can play, you know, 26, 28 minutes a game, defensively stout and moving the puck like nobody's even covering it, right? So I think it's going to be interesting to see, and I do want to turn this to, you know, we've talked a good bit last night about what it's going to look like to see the strength of the Predators come up against the strength of the Penguins, and, you know, weakness versus, well, quote unquote, weakness versus weakness. But it's going to be interesting to see how the Pens handle a really strong breakout team like Nashville, which essentially mirrors some of that game plan that we saw from the Penguins last season. So what are we looking at, Andrew? What are we looking at for seeing this Penguins team? Are we going to see a counterpunch team? Are we going to see them go at it like they did at the end of the Ottawa series? What are we looking for?
Well, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to kind of see how it actually plays out, you know, because as you said, Mike, I think the Nashville, you know, they really actually play a style that's not that dissimilar from what the Pens have done in terms of their defensive mm-hmm. posture. I mean, they play, I mean, I view it as like a 1-2-2 trap. I did read this morning, Jesse Marshall posted his telestrator for this round, and he referred to their trap as being more of a 1-3-1 style, similar, kind of similar mm-hmm. to Ottawa's, but with a much different pressure. In fact, they're actually a very aggressive pressuring team, whereas, you know, Ottawa's like very laid back. In fact, Ottawa, like, I don't know if you noticed this, Mike, but like they played a 1-4 like a straight, right, like one forechecker who was pretty passive, right, and then four guys lined up on their blue line. I mean, right, you know, when you talk about this is bad hockey, that was bad hockey. Like, it was just like,
yeah.
I mean, there were many instances where I was like, I just want to turn this off. Like, I don't care. Right. I'm not invested in this brand of hockey.
Well, and can you just take a second and explain to us what are you referencing when you say bad hockey? Because, Andrew, they're in the Eastern Conference Finals, so they're not a bad team.
Well,
so what is bad hockey?
Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, they're not a bad team. In fact, unfortunately, I fear that there's going to be a lot of teams that are going to look at what Ottawa did and say, you know what, we can do that. That's not too bad. You know, whereas I think teams that were like, oh, we want to emulate the Penguins, it's like, okay, well, find yourself a Sidney Crosby and an Evgeny Malkin and a Phil Kessel and a Chris Letang, and then right, and then supplement that with guys like Carl Hagelin and Brian Rust and Connor Sheary, and then you're, and that's just the forwards basically, except for Letang,
right?
You know, but so anyway, like a 1-3-1, it's basically just like, or well, and what Ottawa did was just, I mean, they literally were completely content to, you know, play for a 1-0 lead and then literally just smother the puck in the neutral zone and basically just grind out the rest of the game. I mean, I think, you know, looking back at like game one of that series, even, you know, they literally scored kind of early on in the game, and, you know, basically they just sat and didn't let the Penguins get into their zone very cleanly. And when they did get in, then they, you know, they would have a guy get in and retrieve the puck and just push it back to neutral ice, you know, and it's just not very aesthetic, I guess, you know, it's, right. I mean, it's not necessarily high skill, and I mean, they kind of relied on their own counterpunch, but even that was kind of like, I mean, they, you know, I feel like Ottawa has some talented players. I mean, you know, Bobby Ryan had a fantastic postseason. Mike Hoffman and Mark Stone are really good, you know, and those guys made a difference, and, you know, and really gave the Penguins some problems, because they kind of have that just puck talent that we've been talking about that the Penguins kind of have, you know, but at the same time, it's just like, you can go 15 minutes without hearing those guys' name, because Ottawa is just content to sit back and again, just kind of force the puck to kind of stay in the neutral zone or try to push it into the Penguin zone. But then, you know, as soon as any kind of pressure from the Penguins would come, like on a forecheck or trying to break the puck out, you know, Ottawa would retreat and they would just go back to that posture where they, you know, literally just stacked all of their guys on the blue line, on their own blue line, and just kept the puck from crossing in. But so with all of that,
so
good.
Yeah. Well, and here's like, I want to talk about why I think that's such a damaging thing for the game, because what ends up happening is that, when you look at a team like Ottawa who runs that type of defensive strategy, what it results in is a lot of turnovers, but they're turnovers not in dangerous areas.
Right.
So it's turnover at the blue line, the attacking blue line, but because they have four guys stacked right there, there's nobody going the other way, right?
Right.
There's no forward that's cheating up looking for an odd man rush. There's nobody coming off the bench, like, you know, flying the zone, looking ready to, you know, take a breakaway or something like
that. Yeah, and I think...
And it's boring because it doesn't generate scoring chances.
Right.
It just generates turnovers in the middle of the ice, literally at the very center of the ice.
Yeah.
And then you're hoping that it's going to generate some controlled zone entries for Ottawa, and that they can outwork the other team, either down low or let Erik Karlsson continue just to take elite passes and shots from the blue line.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that actually, you know, stands as a pretty good contrast to what the Penguins do when they kind of align in their neutral zone trap. You know, they, I mean, the Penguins, you know, they can kind of play either, you know, fairly passive like we saw from Ottawa, or they can be a bit more aggressive. And particularly if they are being a little bit more aggressive, you know, it tends to, you know, that's how we see, you know, almost every game, at least one instance where like Phil is coming in on a semi breakaway, or, you know, somehow or other he's managed to like get the puck with all kinds of space around him. And that's because of how the Pens try to trap and, you know, create, you know, odd man situations that will turn into a 3-on-2 or a 3-on-1 or similar, you know, and it's a much different kind of look, because that's because the Penguins play it a bit more aggressively. And that's you know, and that's what we're going to see from Nashville as well, is that they're going to try to pressure the puck into danger areas with their trap formation, their neutral zone formation. And that's, you know, and that's kind of how they have to get things done, especially because they're, I mean, they're missing, you know, a lot of talent at center. Well, mostly in the form of Ryan Johansson anyway. I mean, even their second line center, who's also injured, Mike Fisher, is like, I was shocked when I read that, like, his points per 60 for this year are lower than Nick Bonino's. And I thought that, like, you could have told me that Bonino maybe scored 20 points all year, and I'd probably believe it.
Right. Which he finished at, like, 40, mid-40s, right?
Yeah, he actually had a better year than I maybe thought he did. And I think he had, like, 17 goals or something. So, I mean, not actually as bad as you would think. But, you know, like, Nashville's offensive talent comes from the wings. I mean, it's your guys like Philip Forsberg, Victor Arvidsson, and James Neal in particular. You know, and they're all wingers. So basically, once again, it's like what Nashville kind of has to do is that they need to create those situations like I was describing with Phil. Is they need those guys to be able to get in on a rush where they have a numerical advantage. And in order to do that, they need to set up an aggressive neutral zone trap.
So here's I think you're right. I think it's going to be really interesting. It's going to be, I think, the exact opposite type of series that you're going to see that we saw from Ottawa. So in the Ottawa series, here's and I think this is more of a like kind of a microcosm of what that series was. The first odd man break in the first game of that series, so Pens at home that they lost, you know, 3-2. The first odd man break that happened was when Olli Maatta blew a tire and gave Bobby Ryan basically a breakaway in overtime for the game winner.
Right.
And so you saw two teams who just defensively were playing very sound, or I think in reality, one team that was unwilling to challenge whatsoever.
Yes.
And just another team that just wasn't being dumb with their defensemen.
Right.
And so I think given the way that both Nashville and the Penguins play, you're going to see, because they both run something of a 1-2-2. I know, you know, Jesse Marshall said that it was the 1-3-1, and that's fair, but both teams pressure, right? Both teams pressure the opposing team's blue line. And so you're going to see layers over top of layers.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas with Ottawa, because they were stacking four guys across the blue line, the Penguins can't go off sides. And so you've got literally the top of the Penguins' attacking formation going up against the wall that is Ottawa's defense.
Right.
And so you're just going to get a lot of smacking, like face to first, just hopefully being able to break through because somebody blows a tire or generates a turnover or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think with this series, you're going to see a lot of those layers of the forecheck and layers of the defensive posture intermingling with one another. And so I think this is going to be a series whereas Ottawa was more of that kind of grind them down, wear them down type of series, this one is going to have to be relying on hockey smarts to see and take advantage of skaters out of place. So it's going to have to be, you know, that quick, really talented play with a puck, getting it in deep or making the cross seam pass or something like that. And it's for both sides, not just the Penguins. It's going to be for both sides. So I think this is going to be a much higher scoring series,
mm-hmm.
Just simply because, like, Nashville wants to attack, right? They want to win games more than just 1-0 or 2-1. And I also think because I think really that the Penguins are going to expose Pekka Rinne as not the elite goaltender that he has seemed to be this postseason.
Right.
So that's part of my prediction for it. I think it's going to be fun hockey, not necessarily because maybe the games are going to be super high scoring. I think they will be, but it's going to be fun hockey because they're going to go back and forth with scoring chances.
Yeah.
And honestly, that's really good for the sport, right? Like, it's really good to see teams that, you know, one, you know, scoring chance at one end of the rink go down, scoring chance at the other end of the rink and getting back and forth within that, with that, you know, quote unquote track meet type of hockey.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, not a whole lot of point in looking back and try to make this brief, but it's like, you know, you look at what this Stanley Cup final could have been in terms of like a very slow, plodding, heavy Randy Carlyle coached Anaheim team versus, you know, the what we just saw from Ottawa. And, like, right. I mean, that would have literally, you know, I think irrevocably turned some people off from giving hockey a chance. Whereas now I think we get almost the best case scenario where, you know, you get a couple of very talented teams with a lot of, you know, with a lot of horses that can just, you know, fly. And I think we're going to see, you know, we're going to see a handful of chances, you know, certainly. And I think it could open up, but I also think it's just, it's going to be an interesting dynamic just to see who can kind of, you know, ultimately win out between, you know, sort of the Penguins' top six versus Nashville's top four. And I know that's a little bit of a cliched thing to say, but, you know, I think that's really where this series is going to shine. You know, because I think when you look at, I mean, there's a lot that's been written about what, you know, what PK Subban and Matthias Ekholm have been able to do against, you know, the top line from Chicago, from St. Louis, like with Vladimir Tarasenko, and then with Anaheim, with Ryan Getzlaf, who's playing some of the best hockey he's played in probably a decade. You know, and you know, basically those guys limited those top lines to a combined three goals. You know, now you can say whatever you want, you know, in terms of, you know, what those guys bring to the table, but I don't know that any of them are Sidney Crosby. You know, and Sid's been just playing some inspired hockey as well, for sure. I mean, he's been really, really good, even if he's still trailing, you know, Gino by several points in playoff scoring. And then I think, you know, the next step from that is, you know, certainly if you look at Chicago and like their second line has, you know, Artemi Panarin and Patrick Kane on it. So, I mean, that's a very, very good second line. But once again, I don't know if that line is better than, say, you know, what Malkin and Phil can bring, you know, as a second line. So I think that'll be an interesting line or an interesting matchup, you know, just to see if one team can get an advantage over the other. And I think otherwise, it, you know, it really could come down to depth. You know, Nashville's third defense pairing is, I mean, for as amazing as their top two pairings are, their third pairing is probably equally as bad. you know, and on the other side of things, it's like that the third and fourth lines for Pittsburgh are just like, you know, they've been pretty ho-hum. I mean, I think, you know, I think we saw a pretty good spark from the third line in particular in the Ottawa series, just seeing, you know, Carter Rowney getting in and just cycling for, you know, along with Bonino and whoever else was kind of filling in on the left side because it shifted around a few times. Like just, you know, those guys were able to get a pretty decent cycle going, even if it didn't really show up on the score sheet. You know, but I also think there's an interesting dynamic, you know, in terms of how, you know, Nashville is going to match up against the Penguins defense, which is a whole different kind of can of worms.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to me to see what the depth of this series looks like, because I think it's going to go one of two ways. It's either going to be that, you know, strength cancels out strength, and you're going to have Nashville's top four defensemen against the Penguins' top six forwards, and there's going to be just kind of a this whitewash of, you know, nothing really happens either way. Or I think it's going to be dominance by each of those two, like those respective strengths. And it's going to come down to depth to kind of push them over the hump, so to speak.
Yeah.
In either case, I think depth is going to be the key, right? And you're going to need to see the unlikely heroes step up and make plays and win games for these guys. And if that's the case, right, like, I got to be honest with you, like, I'm a homer at some to some degree. But, like, I really do believe that the Penguins' depth is going to step up and shine. Just because that's what we've seen from them.
Yeah.
It's not that, you know, we're hoping through this, like, Hail Mary pass that we're, you know, hoping that Matt Cullen's going to put up a 10-point series in seven games.
No,
we've just seen guys like Matt Cullen and Nick Bonino and Brian Rust and Tom Kuhn-Hackle, like, just play big minutes and win games for the Penguins, right?
Yeah.
And I, like, I have to believe that there's more opportunity for depth this year than there was last year.
Well, I agree. I mean, I think, you know, I was kind of like looking back on even like some of what people were saying about, you know, last year's Stanley Cup final matchup And, you know, I think there was a lot of people that kind of view, you know, well, a lot of people called out the fact that the Penguins had the superior depth last year. And I think it's almost even, you know, I think last year was maybe a more extreme example. I mean, again, just, I mean, when the, you know, when the Pens are able to have Justin Schultz as like a true third pairing defenseman last year, you know, and all the things that he was able to contribute, you know, that's a big difference than this year where, you know, Justin Schultz playing with broken ribs, if reports are to be believed, is like the best defenseman that the Penguins have available to them.
Right.
You know,
or at least the most offensive defenseman.
Well, exactly. Most gifted offensive defenseman anyway. You know, but I think there's, you know, I think some of those parallels are similar. And I think a lot of people thought that, you know, San Jose's top four and their top two lines could kind of, you know, match up and neutralize the Penguins. And, you know, I think to a certain level they did, you know, but it really, you know, ultimately it didn't matter that much. You know, basically the Pens' third and fourth lines were able to kind of eventually wear down on San Jose. And you know, I'm hopeful that the same can kind of be said here. I mean, I think an interesting development is, you know, if you're looking at the line rushes, which, I mean, that might actually be worth something to kind of talk about a little bit, because it kind of looks like Jake Guentzel might not be playing tonight.
Right.
Which,
and you got to wonder if he's banged up or something, or he's just got the Connor Sheary syndrome from last year.
Yeah. I mean, I think either of those is certainly a possibility. You know, I also think, I mean, I am kind of tending towards he's banged up, because, I mean, this, like, the abuse that he takes, I mean, I think it's second in the league only to Sidney Crosby. You know, just in terms of, like, just getting, like, absolutely thrashed around with no hope of getting any calls. Which is, you know, a story for another day. You know, but so it looks like he might get, you know, this game off. Maybe he'll get a couple games off. You know, I kind of, you know, ultimately, I don't think you can leave the top postseason goal scorer out of the finals forever.
Right.
You know, but I think if the Penguins feel like this is the time to get him some rest, then, you know, who am I to judge? Because certainly that's worked out pretty well for the Pens so far. You know, but I mean, just looking at the Penguins' fourth line for this game, you know, assuming that Patrick Hornquist is able to go, I mean, it's going to be like Carl Hagelin, Matt Cullen, and Patrick Hornquist. And, like, to me, that is a right. decided advantage for the Penguins compared right. to, like, a fourth line for Nashville that's probably going to have, like, Harry Zolnerchuk on it and Vern Fiddler as the center. Like, that, you know, that's definite advantage for the Pens.
Sure.
You know, so, I mean, I think depth is definitely going to be important. And I think there's other components that are going to make a difference as well. You know, I think one of the things that Nashville wants to do, especially with their center problems with, you know, with Johansson out and Mike Fisher probably not ready for the start of this round, at least I haven't heard that he's going to be ready to play, is that they're very much a stretch pass team. Which mm-hmm. is interesting because I don't think that plays favorably against what the Penguins like to do in the neutral zone. Mm-hmm. You know, typically, I mean, basically, if you're trying to stretch the ice with, you know, 100 plus foot pass, you know, having a whole bunch of guys back, you know, just kind of waiting on the puck to get there is probably not a good solution. And, right. you know, and that's kind of how the Pens have, you know, been lining up. So I think that'll be interesting. Although, I mean, it could be neutralized by the fact that I think if they wanted to, Nashville's defensemen can carry the puck with,
right.
you know, with better alacrity than, you know, than the Penguins can.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to me. I think one of the things that you see that we saw at the end of the Ottawa series that's going to continue to play into the dynamic that we see here is that Mike Sullivan went to, and I think there's a difference between I want to distinguish between depth and balance, okay? Because this is a huge point for me. So last year we saw depth, right? We saw the Penguins load up with the Crosby unit, the Malkin unit, and then we have the cult hero HBK line,
right?
And then we have the emergence of, as the Steve Dangle podcast has put it, capable bum line led by 39-year-old Matt Cullen and Eric Fair and Tommy Kuhn-Hackl,
yeah.
right?
Yep.
So that's, to me, that's not a balanced approach to scoring
mm-hmm.
because you've got the top two lines that are scoring, you know, combined 160 points a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got other guys who at the end of the season in the playoffs emerged as other, you know, 50, like if, you know, if you continue to project those totals, other 50, 60, 70 point scorers on your third and fourth lines. And number one, completely unsustainable. So it was a run. We get that.
Yes. And now it's
but
done.
It was not. Yes, it's done. But it's not a balanced set of scoring. What you have right now is I'm looking at the lines reported by the DK Pittsburgh Sports. You've got Kunitz, Crosby, Sheary. So you've got, we know that the Crosby Sheary pairing has produced magic that was, you know, akin to the 2010-11 Crosby Kunitz pairing. And then you've got Chris Kunitz, who's going to go in and make space and bang bodies and play hard on the boards and win puck battles, right? And then you've got Malkin and Kessel, and we've seen the magic this postseason between those two guys. And then Scott Wilson, who has had his fair share of chances but just hasn't buried them. But how has he generated them? Well, he's going hard into the boards. He's winning puck battles. He's banging bodies. He's making the plays difficult for whatever defensemen are going back for those puck retrievals.
Yeah.
And then you've got Nick Bonino and Brian Rust, who we know that Brian Rust has been a big game performer. He's got something like 10 points in 7 elimination games, which is absurd. You know, sit down Justin Williams.
Yeah.
And then you've got Carter Rowney, who's going to go in, win puck battles, bang bodies, you know, make it hard. Like, you're seeing this theme emerge where you've got, and then the same thing with Cullen and Hornquist, right? So you've got this balance where you've got one guy on every line who's going to go in and has kind of got that, I love that description. It's like that water bug style that's going to go in and just be elusive, be slippery, be, you know, win the occasional puck battle, but it's just going to be hard to keep track of. And then one guy who's going to go in and win puck battles in the corners, he's going to do the what we saw Mike Babcock do with Austin Matthews and Zach Hyman. Zach Hyman is not the finesse guy, right? He's not the guy that's going to chip in, you know, 90 points a year because he's got a phenomenal shot, incredible vision. No, he just goes in and makes it difficult, and he always makes the right play. And we've got one of those guys on every one of these lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this balance between a really heady and smart center who's got a super high hockey IQ, some of them more talented than others.
Yes.
You've got one guy who's fast, who's slippery, who's going to get in and initiate the forecheck.
Mm-hmm.
And then you got another guy who's going to come in and bang bodies, win puck battles, and make space for these other two.
Yeah.
And I think it's a brilliant play by Mike Sullivan to say, you know what? The skill ranges on these four lines between obviously elite generational talent to capable bum.
Yes.
but you've got balance on each one of these lines has the, in my opinion, has the exact same identity.
Yeah.
That you've got one guy who's going to come in, who's going to bang bodies, who's going to make space. You've got one guy who's going to be slippery, who's going to make plays out of corners, who's going to find passes, who's going to take the sneaky shots. And you've got a really heady center. Also, I just got an update from DK Sports that Patrick Hornquist will be playing tonight.
Yeah, and actually one other note. I was just looking at Twitter just now, and it looks like maybe Guentzel is going to stay in, and Hagelin is going to come out of the lineup.
Okay,
so
I like that.
Yeah, actually, I'm gonna be honest. I mean, personally, to me, that's the way I would have done it. But I was also assuming that, like, seeing the news from yesterday where, like, Guentzel wasn't taking the normal line rushes, that, you know, it was probably an injury concern.
Sure.
But yeah, I think that's the optimized lineup.
Yeah. But all that said, there's a really strong identity top to bottom in this lineup. And from what we saw from Sullivan last year, you go back to, you know, early 2016 when the Pens started to catch fire. I remember a press conference that he did where they were talking about, somebody asked him a question about forechecking pressure. Typically, that's a positional awareness kind of thing, that the right wing is going to play this poor checking pressure, the left wing is going to play this, and the center is going to do this. And you have to, if you're, you know, playing that position, you have to be in that mark. And I remember Mike Sullivan is part of that just play mantra. He says, we want all of our team to know what every position is supposed to do so that that situational awareness, that really high hockey IQ can kick in. And if, you know, typically if the center's playing that F2 position, but he's not close to it and the left winger is, well, that left winger can play it because he knows exactly what's going on. And so what it allows the Penguins to do is to get into that forechecking formation much more quickly because it's a situationally adapted approach.
Right.
Now, you have to have a really, really high level of communication, trust for your teammates, and a really high hockey IQ to know what each situation calls for. But, I mean, that's this team top to bottom.
Right.
And so when I look at that, I'm seeing this really workman-like balanced approach to every line. We're going to go out. Each line is going to do the same thing, and we're going to try to wear down the opposition. And that's what you saw in Ottawa, mm-hmm. right?
Oh, like, absolutely.
I mean, you saw them just absolutely shell the Senators. It starts with the, you know, the famed, what is it, like 120-second shift?
Yes.
Where the Penguins rotated through three lines and did the exact same thing on every shift.
Yeah.
It wasn't as if each line had a new identity that came out and started winning puck battles. It was literally, we're going to cycle low from the low corner up to the defenseman. We're going to drop down. There's going to be high cycles in the, you know, out near the blue line, and we're just going to continue to retain the puck until an opening pops up, throw the puck on net, try to score a goal. That's what happened.
Yeah.
So I think it's going to be really interesting to see the Pens do that with this more balanced approach as opposed to this like significantly deep approach that they had last season.
Yeah. No, I completely, I co-sign all of that. I think that's ultimately going to be the key. And I think, you know, one kind of last kind of note that I don't know if we can wrap it up on this or whatever, but I think one thing that that could also play a factor in that, you know, once again, so I kind of mentioned that Nashville is a team that likes to use stretch passes, which means that, you know, mm-hmm. they kind of like to send their forwards kind of early. And that's all well and good, but, you know, I feel like the Penguins have done such a good job, particularly in that Ottawa series, in getting their defensemen to activate, you know, and to help right. sustain that offensive zone pressure, that I think that's going to disrupt what Nashville has been doing. I mean, that's not to say right. that Nashville can't come up with another solution. I mean, again, you know, I have all the respect for Nashville's talent and all the respect for Nashville's, for that vaunted top four defenseman. You know, I mean, I don't even know that I've actually named Roman Josi and Ryan Ellis yet. But I mean, those guys are,
right.
you know, I mean, those guys are bona fide, you know, every one of those four guys is a number two on any team in the league, probably.
Right.
You know, and so at worst, I mean, all the respect to them, and, you know, and I feel confident that they're going to have an answer in some way for what the Penguins have been doing. But with all of that said, it's just like, you know, I think the opportunity remains that the Penguins can continue to get some good cycle time, get some good zone time, and hopefully create some turnovers in the offensive zone. I think that right. that's going to be another key factor. It was very big against Ottawa, you know, and once again, when you're talking about a team that's going to try to trap you pretty aggressively, you need to be able to, you know, when you have that zone time, that offensive zone time, you have to make the most of it. And I think that's going to be the key. So I think, you know, the way that the Penguins can meet that is just, you know, continue to be balanced. Just, you know, be hard on pucks when they can be and get pucks to the net and, you know, just kind of make sure that everybody remains active and involved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, it's going to be an interesting, it's going to be an interesting series, I think, because Peter LaViolette is no slouch of a coach.
Oh, no.
Like, let's give him credit where credit is due. He is not a slouch of a coach.
Nah. Did you see the article from – I honestly don't remember who actually wrote it, but they were saying that, like, when Rutherford came to Pittsburgh, like, he was desperately trying to get LaViolette, but he had, like –
I did not see that.
Yeah, but he was, like, already in final negotiations with Nashville to take over their job at the same time.
Okay.
And so that was just how that all kind of came to pass. But yeah, I mean, so like, I have legitimate respect for LaViolette, even despite the 2012 Flyers playoff series,
sure.
and yelling over the boards at Tony Granato and all of that.
You know what? Like, here's the thing, man. Like, I think in what makes him a good coach is that he's willing to adjust more so than any coach that we've seen this postseason.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, that's...
With, I have to like, John Tortorella is just, like, you know, smack his head off the wall.
Yeah.
And just continue. Except for, you know, game five, where they actually got eliminated.
yeah.
Barry Trotz's inability to come up with a scheme that's actually going to beat the Penguins' counterpunch.
I lost every ounce of respect for Trotz this postseason. Because it's like, literally, I mean, the Penguins beat him by doing exactly what they did last year. Like, they literally, in order to beat them, they actually turned back to what they had previously done. And, right. And I feel like Sully was like, I can't believe that, you know, they didn't change things, or that they're not reacting to the fact that we're literally trapping them in exactly the same fashion.
Well, in just, I don't want to go off on this because we're nearing into that hour
yes.
kind of cap here. But I mean, that's because like that team was built only a certain way, right? Like there's only so many tricks that you can ask Alexander Ovechkin to do.
Well, that's true.
And play differently is not one of them, right?
yeah.
Like, so I'm just saying that, you know, and this, I think, goes back to the kind of premise of our podcast as a whole, that, like, personnel influences strategies and strategies influence personnel.
Right.
And then, you know, again, the same thing with Guy Boucher, right? Like, that team is built a certain way. And when they came out, when they used transition to, you know, aid their cause, they beat the Penguins 5-1 very, very sound, very, very handedly.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, they're playing basically their normal game plan, they get smoked 7-0. So, like, I guess all that is to say, the three coaches that we've seen thus far into the playoffs are not good adaptive coaches.
Right.
And I think in the same way, I mean, all credit to Nashville because they've played three very different series.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's in the same way that the Pens have played. Every series has been very different in terms of the strategy required to oust that opponent. I mean, Nashville's had the same thing. Like, you say it, like, you say what you want about the Blackhawks, but, like, very different team than playing against the Randy Carlyle Anaheim Ducks.
Oh, for sure, yeah. And, you know, and it...
In fact, very opposite teams.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, you know, Chicago is very much a team that is, you know, trying to move the puck forward, is trying to, you know, suppress shots by just holding on to the puck forever, you know, whereas, you know, certainly Anaheim was kind of the opposite. You know, they're very much a right. sound defensive team. You know, they sort of want a counterpunch. It's a little bit different because, you know, I think they're just kind of big and heavy, you know, but I think it's very much a different dynamic. And I think, yeah. you know, St. Louis is certainly unique from either of those teams as well.
Yeah.
You know, so I think that says a lot about, you know, how these two teams got to be in the Stanley Cup final and
right.
why that matters.
yeah. Well, in the, so here's where I want to close with. We've kind of come up with a few narratives that potentially are being put to bed at this very moment right now, and I think it's wise to maybe close with that. So the first one, I just want to run through these really quickly because this might be the least debated, but we'll see, that Mike Sullivan is the best coach that the Penguins have ever had and potentially one of the best coaches in the league right now.
Yes. I mean, it's, you know,
what
it's
you
funny.
Yes,
you know,
agree.
All of the history around Penguins coaches is that, you know, if you want to win the Stanley Cup, you have to do it in your first year because none of them have ever made a return appearance. None of them. I mean,
right.
I mean, obviously, you know, Bob Johnson, obviously a little bit of a different situation. Unfortunately, passed away.
Right.
Scotty Bowman didn't make it back in his second year. And we're talking about, you know, the greatest coach of all time.
Right.
You know, Bielsma obviously failed. Which other discussions to be had about that poor guy, sort of, not really. and, you know, sort of now we have Sully and here he is 2 years in a row.
I also like that you just completely glossed over Michel Therrien.
Oh yeah. well, yeah. Therrien who got fired after, his first appearance.
right.
So sorry about that, Michel. but yeah, I mean, you know, it's a famous quote from soccer that, you know, a good coach slash manager can make a team 10% better and a bad one can make a team 30% worse. And it's like, you know, I don't really know how that compares to hockey, but I feel like Sullivan is doing much more than 10% to make this team better.
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think he is the best the coach in Penn's history, just for the simple fact that he has coached this team through so many injuries to this a sustained level of success and has done it in different ways, right? That it's not been game plan, you know, attack plan alpha from the gate, and we're just going to continue to grind this into the ground. Yes, that is a Dan Biles yes. reference.
Until grind these bitches down. Eliminated.
Yeah. I do not miss that. But you see Sullivan changing. You see him evolving. You see this team evolving.
Right.
Love it. I think he is the best coach in Penn's history.
Yeah.
In terms of best coach in the league right now, this might be controversial. I'm not ready to give it to him.
No, and I think that's fair.
I think he's been the best coach this year. Mm-hmm. Yes, for sure. Yeah. But I don't think he's the best coach in the league just because, I mean, he's only got, you know, a year and a half of coaching experience with success.
Right.
So let's see it play out over 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if he, you know, if he becomes the American Babcock, then, you know, I obviously we'll have an answer with, you know, in terms of that.
Right.
But, yeah. And, you know, and I think just one last like little note in like, I think I even mentioned this to you yesterday, Mike, but, you know, I was talking about the Garage League podcast with Andy Smith and Lyle Kosas. I love it. I mean, they're perfectly contrarian and sort of so pessimistic that it kind of revitalizes my spirit a little bit. just because, like, you know, I think I tend to get a little too gushy sometimes about the Penguins. And sure. And I feel like, you know, they're kind of, they've raised this question that, like, okay, so why aren't the Penguins dominating possession as much as they did last year? And, mm-hmm. you know, and they're saying, you know, whatever the case may be, it's like, you know, Sullivan, he's changed as a coach, and they're not convinced that it's in a good way. But I also feel like Sullivan isn't purposely necessarily changing as a coach. He's just changing based on this, you know, the conditions that he's presented with. And, right. you know, and I think that's the most important thing. You know, it's like, I mean, if you liked possession hockey, then why isn't Dan Bylsma still the coach? I mean, right. he was pretty good at it. It didn't lead to much success, but he was pretty good at,
right.
you know, pushing that Corsi up over, you know, 53%, 54% every year. But then it ultimately came crashing yeah. down. Whereas, you know, with Sullivan, you know, maybe they're not dominating on that front as much, but they're still making it happen. They're winning, and that's all that really yeah. matters.
That's true. That's true. I also am going to have to apologize. I think either neighbors or downstairs folks that I'm living with are currently playing the drums. So if we're picking that up on the microphones, I apologize for that yeah. ahead of time.
Well, I think I heard my dog barking earlier, so it's just going to be a okay. wonderful audio quality.
Good, good. Well, let's fly through these because we're already over an hour.
Yeah.
So, okay, does Sidney Crosby have anything left to prove to anybody in the NHL?
Absolutely not. I mean, he hasn't for a while. I think that's kind of above reproach, but I just love Pierre LeBrun, you know, one of the probably, you know, most recognizable names in terms of hockey writing, you know, mm-hmm. With this headline, if Crosby wins back to back, that elevates him above Taves. I mean, I know that he's getting at like the leadership component or whatever, but like even that's completely overplayed. I mean, they've played in two Olympics together, and who was the captain for both of those Olympic teams? Like, well, actually, I guess 2010.
Sidney Crosby.
Yeah. Well, actually, I guess 2010 was Scott Niedermeyer was the captain, but Sid was an alternate. Right. And then in 2014, Sid was the captain. And then in the World yeah. Cup of Hockey, Sid was the captain. So
right.
I think that says all you need to know. Moving on from that, though, do you looking at this other one that like LeBron in the same sentence is also saying that he thinks that Sid is one of the top five greatest players in NHL history. Thoughts on that one?
I still can't divorce it from the fact that he's trying to tell me that Jonathan Toews is a better hockey player in any capacity
yes, that there's,
than Sidney Crosby is.
Yes, that there's...
Like, literally in any capacity.
Right.
I think that's a really hard thing to say while a player is still active.
Exactly. And, I mean...
Like, I just think it's so hard to say... I mean, and this is somebody who's a huge Sid fan.
Mm-hmm.
There is no doubt that Sidney Crosby is the best of this generation.
Yes.
No doubt. But that said, man, he's only 30.
Yeah, and not even. I mean, he's still 29 right now.
He's still got a lot of gas left in the tank. You know, there's we don't have the mediocre years of Crosby. You don't know where he's going to end up after this, you know, this long deal that he's on right now. You know, he could end up somewhere else and, you know, win a cup or two as the wily veteran of a team.
Right.
You know, the former great, right? Yeah. You know, we just don't know what's going to happen. And so when that's all said and done, you know, man, if the Pens win a Stanley Cup this year, that means that Sidney Crosby has 3 Stanley Cups and he's not even 30 yet.
Right. Have played
there's,
in four.
I mean, there's a very real... yeah, exactly. Like, I mean, you know, there's a very real chance that the dude ends up with 4, 5, 6 cups. Yeah. Like, because, I mean, there's a lot of other teams in the league that, like, are going to be up-and-comers. Like, who's to say that, you know, 5 years from now, if the Penguins take a huge nosedive and they're just, like, going to full-on rebuild mode, who's to say that Sidney Crosby doesn't end up in a place like Toronto? You know, like,
yeah, absolutely.
We have no idea. And can you imagine a 1-2 punch of Austin Matthews and Sidney Crosby any team?
Oh, I mean,
it'd be disgusting. Yeah.
No, I completely agree.
We just can't say, I don't think we can say at this point that he's, you know, top 5 in anything other than compared to the people that he's playing against right now.
Right.
Which is in this league in this year.
Yeah. And in terms of that, there he has literally no peers. Except for maybe his teammate Evgeny Malkin.
Well, Connor McDavid is giving him a run for his money. Well, give credit where credit is due. Like in terms of, at least in terms of the offensive production.
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, real quickly, I'll be honest. Like, you know, I don't think I would rank Sid that high because I don't know that he has. I mean, you know, he's won everything. You know, at the team level. You know, but I'll be honest. Like, I don't know that he has enough. Maybe like, you know, MVPs or scoring titles or whatever the case may be. And I think it's going to be a hard road to hoe in order to win a couple more of those with McDavid kind of breathing down his back.
Right. Yeah, that's fair. I think that's totally fair.
Yeah. You know,
and that's in before we catch any flack about, oh, these guys don't like Sidney Crosby. That's not the case.
No.
Right. Like this is not either one of us saying Sid sucks, trade Sid. Yeah. Not what we're saying. What we're saying is that Sid's contribution to cup-winning teams is not the spectacular individual effort that was a Mario Lemieux or a Wayne Gretzky or a, you know, Jaromir Jagr. Like, this is the dude who elevates the game of everybody around him so significantly that those teams get better because he's on them as a sum, not as individual parts.
Right.
And that's just a very different skill set than those other guys have.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, we'll see where it goes. I mean, I'm certainly more than willing to have that discussion maybe in another 10 years or so, you know, but as I say, I just think it's like premature right now. You know, I think even comparing him to like, you know, like say Jaromir Jagr, it's like, you know, I mean, where, like if Jagr's not one of the top 5 players of all time, where does he rank? You know, and I think that gets into a different discussion, but kind of moving on from that, I guess, this notion that we can't settle on whether Evgeny Malkin is good or not.
According to what metrics? Because last time I checked, all of the ones that count, Evgeny Malkin is very good at hockey.
Yeah. No, I mean, you know, I brought him up earlier as possibly the only legitimate, like, you know, somewhat peer to Sid in this era. And I think that's, I mean, I think that's much closer to being reality than anything else we've discussed. I mean, he's, you know, he's currently got a 4-point lead on Sid, you know, for the scoring race in the postseason. I mean, if he gets like a second Conn Smythe, I mean, it's unreal. I mean, there's very, very few people that win multiple Conn Smythes in a career. You know, and personally, I think that's where my, you know, sentiment would lie is that that if the Pens win the cup, he's the Conn Smythe favorite, unless like Sid has an insane final.
I mean, you can make a case for Marc-Andre Fleury for the carrying them for the first two rounds.
Yeah.
but I don't think there's many people beyond Malkin, Fleury, and Sid that can be considered.
Right.
Unless there's a, you know, some dark horse pick that comes out and just like obliterates the Predators over the course of, you know, this series.
Yeah.
But I don't foresee that happening.
No, I kind of don't either. You know, so, okay, enough said about that. And then...
Yeah. And can we just, like, the fact that Jonathan Toews is in the top 100 players of all time and Evgeny Malkin is not is absolutely ludicrous.
Yeah.
Just throwing that out there.
My favorite tweet that I've seen in forever from Dmitry Filipovich, somebody asked him, well, he was having the debate on like the points needed by Toews to even be in the conversation as being as good as Sid. And then somebody asked him, well, how does that compare to Malkin? And he said, it's more doable. Toews only needs 56 goals and 56 goals and 154 assists in negative 11 games to match the 101st best player of all time. So, yeah. So, I mean, for Geno's career, 706 games played, 832 points. For Toews, 717 games played, 622 points, if those numbers didn't make sense otherwise. So,
yeah.
You know, well, it's a bad joke.
I don't think they make much sense. Yeah. You know, it's just, I think it's a case of, you know, good Canadian boy versus enigmatic Russian again.
Exactly. Even though he's the enigmatic Russian that plays the most like a good Canadian boy, going to the hard areas and doing all this and that.
Who's the most Lemieux-like non-Lemieux of the past 25 years.
Yes. But that's a different story.
Yeah.
But he's still a Russian, and that's all that will probably matter for most people.
Right. Okay, well, let's close this out with, I think we're already at an hour and 10 minutes, so we'll close it with this, man. Just wanted to talk about Matt Murray, but I feel like that's going to be a whole long discussion.
Yeah,
so maybe
we can do that at
the next one. Yep. Here's where I want to close out, man. What's your prediction?
Well, you know, honestly, I've been kind of going back and forth, you know, because I really do like this Preds team, and I think, you know, I think at a certain point, the fact that the Penguins have played, like, I don't know, coming up on, like, 210 games, like, each player in the last 2 years is a lot.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, not something that's easy to bear. But, you know, ultimately, I just think that the Pens have the better team overall, top to bottom. So I'm going to go with, I think, Pens in seven.
Okay. This is where I landed on it. I think it's going to go one of two ways. I think either the Pens are going to eke it out and it's going to be a long, hard-fought series, or the Preds are going to crush them.
Right.
Like, I really just think that that's what it comes down to. I mean, this team's already gassed. They've already been, as you alluded to, 210 games over the past, you know, 2 years is a stupid amount of hockey.
Yes.
And that's, they're banged
up. That's not really counting, like, the whole third of the Penguins roster that played at the World Cup of Hockey before the start of this year.
I mean, you know, it's going to be either the Penguins are going to come in and they're going to continue to do what they've done this postseason and just find a way. They're going to dig deep, find a way. Or the Predators are going to come in and curb stomp them. Like, I think that's really the only two ways that this series is going to go. So I would say Pens in seven or Preds in five. I mean, like, I don't know what else to say. Yeah. You know what I mean?
I shouldn't, like, allow that equivocation, but I like it because I feel like it's entirely accurate. And that's kind of the same thought that I have, you know, is that, you know, I certainly think that the Preds can do this, and if they do it, it's going to be probably a lightning strike. So,
yeah. Okay, well, so for coming up next week, we'll be looking at expansion drafts. We'll be looking at the fact that the Pens have lost a huge front office guy in Jason Botterill. And we'll be taking a look at some of the analysis from this week's game. So for the Reggie's House podcast, I am Mike Swanson. You can follow me on Twitter at I am Mike Swanson. We thank you for listening. Andrew, anything to finish up with?
Just that I am Andrew Roman. I am at Andrew Roman on the Twitter. And we'll talk to you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks for listening. And let's go Pens, eh?
Let's go Pens. Thank you.